This is the September 19 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Elaine Cubb of Mastering the Grain Markets out of Ipswich, South Dakota, Mike Zuzlo at GlobalAnalytics.biz in Atchison, Kansas, and Jerry Gulkey of the Gulkey Group out of Chicago, Illinois. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org, willag.org. Elaine Cubb, I'll start with you. What's on your list to talk about today?
Well, the prices themselves aren't nothing. We're finally getting some movement, but I think it would be interesting to talk about some of the impacts on the broader industry, the agriculture industry, when you have interest rates changing and what the impacts might be of lower yields, or, you know, what's going to happen in these areas where they're just not going to have as much grain as you would like to have in a normal year.
Mike Zuzlo, GlobalAnalytics.biz.
Well, I think the USDA gave us a nice reprieve from the supply bearishness, Todd, but, you know, we're trying to categorize these crops and these yields and how the price action is going to be going into the fall. And I'm still thinking that a 2015 type scenario looks likely, maybe a 1993 scenario if we can get some more things to come together.
And finally, Jerry Gulkey of the Gulkey Group on your list to discuss for the day.
We spent some time looking at last Monday's report on the number of acres not setting pods yet and the number of corn acres not dented yet, and what that means to yields, of course, now it appears that we're going to have an extended growing period. Are we going to be able to fill that, or did these crops shut down and it's too late to add bushels to them like the market expects?
Well, let's start there, Jerry. Why don't you go through some of those numbers from the weekly crop production or crop progress report, rather, and what you found?
Yeah, we totaled up. We went through a number of, 13 different states, Illinois, Indiana, the typical ones. Arkansas was even in there, but actually we didn't include that. But South Dakota, you know, and that area. Some of the big areas, like Illinois, had 695,000 acres, I believe it was, of beans not setting pods. Now, some of that, I'm sure, is double cropped, so that's probably not unusual. But the total acreage in Illinois, Iowa, and then you go to North Dakota that had they were nearly done setting pods. But some of the areas that were Michigan, 92%, Kentucky, 91%. Kentucky's probably double crop, but when you look at all together, about 3.5 million acres had not set pod yet. And then you'd have to take a look at how many of those probably were in harm's way, and that would include the northern tier, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and that area. And then we also looked at not dented, and that was in the millions of acres. I think 28 million we figured it out. And some of those are important, some not. South Dakota, about 3 million acres, 50% was not dented yet. North Dakota, 38% was not dented. Even Iowa, 74% was not dented. And Minnesota, 59% was not dented yet. Now, that's going to progress, but I think we'd look at some of those numbers, and we came up with numbers that suggested there's probably 500,000 bushels of grain that's legitimately at risk. That I looked at it and said, all right, of these important states, we're not going to lose the whole crop if it froze, but at the time we looked at it, there were some thoughts we'd get an early frost. So you get some potential percentage of the potential yield. So if your potential yield was going to be 200 bushels an acre, you might get 180 or 160, but it's going to be wet corn, and then we have to deal with that. But I don't think the market would care so much about how wet it is, but it would be more important as what percentage that we would actually lose. And I think there's a rational idea that we could probably lose 150 million bushels of beans probably through this and not maturing, and also maybe 500,000 bushels of corn, which changes things dramatically from where we're at now if you use the latest yields that was put out in the September crop report. So I think that's important, and Monday we'll get another one, but I think we've run out of time maybe with some of this crop ever maturing to where it's going to reach its full potential regardless of the frost.
Well, do you think that's really the case given the extended growing season for the month of September? This will be one of the warmest on record if it continues. Also will be one of the wettest on record if we continue, and that would be across the whole of the Corn Belt.
Yeah, that is a question, and we don't have a whole lot of historical data for that. I think I looked at I think Mike picked a couple of years, but I looked at 2009. I remember it pretty well. We had to really go into harvest, and actually, if I remember right, the government did another survey on the Northern Plains because they hadn't completed harvest yet, and it took us into the following year. But it wasn't until we were really combining and worked our way north that we really realized that crop wasn't what we thought it was. And it returned, tried to go back to the highs it made. In fact, we made the highs in 2009, right around the same time, June 18th, 1930, I believe. And then backed off, took out most of it, just like we did this year. And then when we rallied back up during harvest, we never did exceed the levels reached in June of that year. And that looks like a repeat. And again, we need some help from the government and from combines ruling that in October, if we could get a crop report that finally admitted that, yeah, we counted the ears, but they're not as big and they're smaller and they're less weight and so forth, then we might get a reduction in this production that would make things a little tighter. There's a big difference between carrying out 2.1 or a 1.7 carry out in corn, because it goes into the next year, which then is a big difference between what we carried in this year. That was a big nemesis, I think, in carrying in about 2.3 billion into this year. Had it been 1.6, we'd be talking about altogether a different situation. And soybeans the same way. We need to get the carry out down to 500 million or less so that we get concerned about the weather in Brazil and maybe even China. I see they're a little dry, but they haven't had a bad crop since 1994, I believe. So a lot of those things put together will determine just how long I guess you might call it a contra-seasonal rally, but for the last 4 years, we made early lows and then rallied into the fall and into December before we gave way to a new crop in South America again. So a lot of moving parts, but I'm just not sure. I talked to a lot of farmers, and they'll tell you just can't make up for late planting. And so this is new history. We will find out. If we do grow a big crop, and that second crop planted in June in corn materializes into an average crop, we got trouble going forward, because then I don't know what would ever kill a crop.
Hey, Mike Suzalo, Jerry alluded to a couple of years that you were thinking about, 2015 and 1993 were the two that you gave me. Can you talk about those and what the comparisons you're making today look like?
Yeah, I think, like Jerry, I think this finishing of the crop is more of a question mark. You bring up a good point about September, but I do think that based upon the northern Corn Belt and even back east of the Mississippi River in the northern third of Illinois and Wisconsin and Michigan and northern Indiana and Ohio, you're going to need most of October as well, or at least the first half of October as well, Todd. So I think the burden is still on the crop being able to finish out, even with this September we've had, a very welcome September. I think the big thing that I'm looking at right now is the difference between a 1993 crop. I don't think we're there yet because of the macro scenario, what we have in terms of another Fed rate cut. We have another drop in the global economy, world trade put out by OECD this week. We still have left on the table and lingering these demand issues of USMCA, ethanol, African swine fever. And so we have enough macro issues that we could keep the dollar elevated. I think for me, the crop conditions are at a point, and the fact that USDA brought the yields down enough that it got the end users off their duff and off their hands, and they're now not thinking as much about just buying hand-to-mouth at this stage, that I think we could be like a 1993 market where we do just continue on higher into October, all the way into December contract expiration, if we do get a true dollar sell signal here on the weekly and monthly charts, which we're really poised to do. And technically, I think that would bring the commodity funds back in. It's interesting that the dollar's on the verge of a sell signal on the weekly and monthly charts, and the Bloomberg Commodity Index is on the verge of a monthly buy signal. So I think 1993 is on the table if we can get the macro off our side. And I got to say, it's for me, for the dollar to get a sell signal, it's giving us a green light, or it's representative of giving us the all clear when it comes to the U.S.-China trade negotiation. So I don't look for a dollar sell signal unless things really smooth out between the United States and China at this point. Otherwise, a 2015 scenario is we get a bump after the September report. We kind of go sideways into harvest. We get one more bump as we get closer to expiration, but we really don't get the retracement or the rally back that we wanted. We really don't get much better than the July levels which we would be very welcome to get, granted, but it would probably be nice to be able to have more solid foundation that we can get back to the July levels and have that dollar sell signal. I think one last thing on the demand side is we saw the weekly export sales in the corn and the beans really come on hard this week. We also saw end users in the wheat come on really hard, and these were Middle Eastern end users. I'm wondering whether the Saudi Arabian fire and the military strikes against Saudi Arabian oil fields by Iran is not pressuring some of the end users now to say, let's get some needs locked in at this point, because we may have some really rough waters ahead as far as logistics and transportation. So that's Saudi Arabia is now a brand new factor out there in the macro side too.
And Lane Cubb, from your vantage point there in Ipswich, South Dakota, what does the crop look like?
You know, it looks all right. And Jerry and I were talking about this a little bit, that the South Dakota, North Dakota crops in the areas where they were planted, there has been such steady rain this year, which is quite unusual for this geography, that it's sort of topsy-turvy. You've got Iowa-looking corn in eastern South Dakota and some sort of North Dakota-looking corn in parts of Iowa and Illinois. So conditions-wise, it's not too bad. But I will say this, is that when Jerry and Mike were both talking about this rally into harvest, I'm right there with them. This is sort of same, same, same. And it's based not only on the fact that I think there are some yield concerns throughout the center of the Corn Belt, which haven't been fully reflected in the government reports. You know, this is sort of a beating a dead horse. But I'm also looking at the harvested acreage numbers. And all I have to tell you about silage cutting this summer is just anecdotes, and a series of anecdotes does not really make data unless it is collected in a regular way, which it's not. So I don't have a nice quantitative study like Jerry had, although I do admire that stuff typically. All I have is anecdotes. And when you talk to the silage cutters this summer, first of all, they are beyond busy. They just cannot get a break with people looking, the demand for people to come out and cut silage. They're just busy, busy, busy. And what they're seeing out there as far as the pounds of silage they're cutting suggests to them, everyone I've spoken to, is that the yields aren't there because of the late planting. So even though you have good conditions, and even though, yes, we have this September that isn't causing us any frost panic yet, nevertheless, the late planting really has affected yield, and I think our ultimate harvested acreage number is going to be south of 80 million acres.
So you alluded to this at the beginning, which was that this will have an impact on some of the outside marketplaces, especially with the lower yield in the ag industry. And I take it you're talking mostly about the livestock sector.
Yeah, livestock and also ethanol. It's coming to the point where ethanol is not really penciling out for whatever reasons. But when you look out in the eastern Corn Belt where the basis is still really strong, there are still cash corn bids that are above $4 in Iowa and in eastern Indiana. And that is not going to be helpful for the end user, for the livestock feeders, or certainly for the ethanol plants in those regions. But not only that, just talking about the industry itself that's handling the grain. You know, I spoke to a co-op operator in Ohio this week who is already, not only his operation, but other elevators in his region have had to lay folks off because they know they're just not going to get the bushels. They're going to get 40% less bushels because they've seen the planted acreage go down. So they're laying off folks. And then you know that when you do have a big crop in 2020, most likely the finding that labor is going to be a challenge. And those parts of the industry just don't receive, you know, the government support, the Trump bucks, or whatever you want to call the paychecks that are coming out of the MFP program that are going directly to farmers. The rest of the industry just doesn't see that kind of stuff.
So I'm going to stay with you, Elaine, for one more question, because you alluded to the ethanol industry. POET, which is located in your state as a headquarters, has said they're going to drop back, by calculations, more than 130 million bushels of grind for ethanol. That is a big deal. How much of a problem is it for the Dakotas and parts of Iowa?
That is a big announcement, and it's a big share of where the corn goes in this state, and Iowa especially, because they do like to use the corn within the state rather than being an exporter. You know, sometimes they're even a net importer in Iowa. But, you know, as they were saying about the exports, you know, we have opportunities in this time frame before Brazil really gets ramped up. We have opportunities to move the corn in another direction.
Mike Zuzulo, I'll come back to you for just a second. In Kansas, what's the crop look like?
Well, we're getting close to running, Todd. I don't think we're drying down as fast as we wanted to at this stage of the game. I am getting some clients starting to get into fields in southern Nebraska where it's been a little bit drier. There's a pretty large feeder cattle lot up by Holdridge, Nebraska, that was running some silage, and it was running at about 250 on 30% moisture, knocks it back down to around 200 bushels. That was a disappointment to them at that stage, or I should say wet corn, not silage, excuse me. There was some silage also being chopped not far from here, and it was running about 15 to 25% less than what they had last year at this time. Also getting some really early yield reports in from western Illinois, closer to the Jacksonville, west central Illinois, Jacksonville area, that had gotten some of the rains but had missed some of the rains. And right now the early corn sounds like it's running about 40, 50 bushels less than last year at this time. Kentucky and Tennessee clients there continue to, for the most part, to hit it out of the park with yields every bit as good as last year. So Nebraska client called me today and said that he was just starting to get into fields, and he's really looking probably at a disappointment on his irrigated fields and wondering whether dry land crops that maybe got planted at a different pace than the irrigated fields may be better, but the irrigated down quite a bit. That would match up with what I had heard in Grand Island at Husker Harvest, that western part of Illinois, or excuse me, Nebraska, probably the better part, east as you get back east towards Omaha, really start to go down quite rapidly. So probably down versus last year, and I'm guessing USDA is a bit high on Nebraska still.
And Jerry Gulke, I know you've been traveling pretty extensively. You have farm there in DeKalb, Illinois, or that area. I think you're under rainfall this afternoon, and in the Dakotas as well.
Yes, and we had a lot of water in the Dakotas. I was up there for Big Iron and program up there they had, and they just got deluged after that. And of course, you heard about Sioux Falls getting that 8 or 9, 10 inches of rain. So there's a, I don't know if it's going to cause disease, but all the wave up 29 to Fargo along the Red River Valley, where they grow the greatest part of the corn bushels per se in North Dakota. A lot of poor corn, I would call it, and short beans, very short beans. And I know in North Dakota we can grow a crop up there on short beans, but I think we've done some permanent damage to the potential that was out there. And this is what this whole year they've been talking about, the potential, and I don't think we reached that. And I was just looking at North Dakota, their yield, I think was at 35 bushels an acre on beans. The government hadn't changed it much. I don't think it would come anywhere close to that because of the eastern half and the good land that was flat black dirt just was saturated. There's a lot of poor soybeans up there. I don't think they were planted on PP acres, and I did not see a lot of corn on PP acres. There was some short corn, but nothing that was knee high. So I think, like Elaine says, there might be a million acres. We're thinking there's a million and a half more unharvested grain to come yet, and certainly the winter, the spring wheat is a problem up there that will be sold as a food feed grain, I guess, at some time. And if they can, some guys will want to bin it, but that's the heavy rains that we've had there that really deteriorated that crop, and I suspect it happened up into Canada as well. So North Dakota's got, you know, I think they plant something shy of 8 million acres of beans. That's a pretty big area of beans to have a problem with. So we'll see what happens there. But it's not as good on the east side on the flat black dirt. And this is what we found really in Illinois too. The rolling ground did pretty well, held the water. But the good soils were saturated all year. And I think that's a problem that we're going to find out when we come to harvest, that the unevenness in the fields are, you can now see it from the overpasses and from the air as well.
Anybody got a feel for Indiana, the northern two-thirds or at least northern third of that state, and the northwest corner of Ohio, both of which were really far behind? And I think there are a lot of PP acres in both places.
Yeah, one of the clients I work with in Allen County, which would be Wapakoneta, and then an elevator client I work with near Toledo, are both saying that what they got in is going to be above average, they think, Todd. I think from Fort Wayne on east, even though they did have PP acres, as you say, what they got in, it sounds like it's going to be very good and every bit as good as last year from what hand counts I'm hearing right now. I did hear, though, down by Columbus, Yellow Springs area, along I-70, silage being chopped, and that was down substantially versus last year. So it seems like that the like we oftentimes see Northwest Ohio, Northeast Indiana, very, very good, but it doesn't take you far south before it starts to get a little bit tough.
And I believe you about the yields there, Mike, but I will just point out that the end users or the grain buyers in that region are still apparently very worried about the overall supply of grain that they're going to see this harvest, because we're still seeing really high basis bids for corn, for old crop corn, or for whatever corn is coming in right now. They're in that Western Ohio, Eastern Indiana area. I'm looking at like 35 over, 42 over, 20 over. And this isn't as high as it was earlier in the summer. I believe in about the start of July, we saw basis bids in that Eastern Corn Belt area that were 65 over, but they're still strong, which suggests to me that the reality is buyers are going out there seeing that just from the acreage loss, they're not going to have the bushels they want, and they're still being really competitive.
Yeah, so it's just acreage versus yield at that point. They can still have a pretty decent crop, right, Mike? But acreage just isn't there at this point. Mike, I want to stay with you for just a second on some larger issues this week. The Chinese are in Washington, D.C. Mostly lower level folks are trying to work out some details for a larger agreement that could come in the month of October. Do you think we're far enough along and under enough pressure in both countries, meaning that the Trump administration may not want to put extra tariffs on going into the Christmas season, and that the Chinese are worried about consumer food prices, that we could have a deal that would involve agricultural products?
Yeah, I do think we're as close as we've ever been at this point, Todd. And I think it helps a lot that Brazilian Paranagua soybeans are $30 a ton more expensive than U.S. Gulf beans. And I think if we can't get something done here in the next couple weeks, then it's going to be extremely difficult to get anything done going into the fourth quarter or in the fourth quarter. And then it gets harder and harder and harder as we get into the election season. And President Trump's already alluded to that. I've got four stories that I've kept track of in the Chinese and Japanese newspapers this week. Hong Kong is still at a point where they're canceling some of their big National Day, Chinese National Day holiday stuff. We've got the U.S. maybe calling out China on human rights violations at the United Nations next week. We've also got Vice President Pence canceling a meeting in the Solomon Islands because of their allegiance with China. What this all says to me, and I've left out a couple things, but what this all says to me is that the ag policy, trade policy is still very much tied to our foreign policy. And so that's why I'd really like to see some details, not just on USMCA and ethanol and some of the other issues, but all, most importantly, the U.S.-China trade deal, and see the dollar give a sell signal, because I think that's best representative that the market is kind of signaling or would be signaling the all clear.
I'd like to get from each of you a feel, because I'm just not sure where we are at this point, other than maybe it's just sideways to higher is what the thought is going into the harvest season for both corn and soybeans. I'll start with you, Jerry Gulke.
Yeah, we're of the same mind. I like what Mike said about the dollar turning. If you look at the weekly signals in beans and corn not so much, but beans are turning. We need help yet, of course, this week and the following week. And also from a monthly standpoint, I think, if I'm not mistaken, soybeans could post a monthly reversal if we could get some more legs on it. And if that were to happen, technically that sounds pretty good. I look at it as saying that the market has looked at all the details that we're talking about, the previous, you know, comments about crop or the lack thereof and weather, and still chose to close higher than the previous month going into harvest. I think that's a pretty good sign. And I think the farmer has, you know, he's gotten quite a bit of money. It may not be enough in his mind, but I think we have holding power that we've proven we have in storage and holding grain off the market. And I don't think there's going to be a panic to sell grain down here. Give us 40 cents more in the beans, perhaps, and 40 cents more in corn. I think you'll bring a lot of grain out of the woodwork. And I've started to look ahead into 2020 with the a call. We like to sell a call sometimes if we don't have a good handle on the long-term trend and the markets and the weather in South America. you know, you can get paid pretty well for selling an option, even out into November beans next year and December corn of 220. That says on part of my production, I'm willing to get paid 20 cents a bushel for the right to sell my corn to you for 410 or 420. I think a $4 corn and 420 corn for next year will probably bring a lot of corn in the market. So we're looking quite a ways ahead, even though we still have grain left for this year to sell.
Elaine Cubb, your marketing analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. That I'm bullish for going through into harvest, and absolutely we should be looking at 2020. So that December 2020 futures price really hasn't bopped below $4, which is sort of a psychological lever that a lot of farmers like to think about. So if we do have some sort of a rally going into harvest and 2020 follows along, or the spreads just kind of go along all the way along the calendar, that's something we really have to think about. Because think about what the supply scenario would have been this year if we hadn't had all of the planting troubles in the spring. If you have a year when you have a real trend line yield, you know, which is going to be upwards of 177 bushels per acre as we go along year to year, we're talking about huge stocks to use ratios in a very bearish scenario. So the opportunity to lock in that $4 price level of 410 or 420, like Jerry was mentioning, that's something that we are going to wish we had when the time comes along that we actually have the yields that we can produce in this country.
And Mike Zuzulo.
The only thing I'll cover that the others didn't, that I agree with wholeheartedly, is the technicals on the daily corn continuation did give us a gap after the September contract expired and we had the USDA report. So I'm leery of a pullback and filling of that gap because the funds tend to like to do that if they don't keep feeding the bull. So that's one thing to really watch as we go into next week. I think we've got the wheat low in now, Todd, at this point, in my opinion. We need to see the bean low in place, especially with fresh African swine fever in some major league countries in Southeast Asia. I think we could get that from what Jerry and Elaine were talking about earlier in terms of the crop conditions and the acres. Watch the crop conditions next Monday. We're coming in at 54% good to excellent as of this week. That's the lowest since 2013 when it was 50%. If we don't see any gains at that point, and we do get a cold weather blast at the end of this month, like some of the models are suggesting, USDA's 47.5, 47.9 national yield may need to be adjusted down towards the 2015 national yield of around 44 bushels, because, again, that's kind of where we're at in terms of good to excellent. And in terms of percent dropping leaves right around that area. If we could get that, then I think we'd have a situation where the wheat low being in, the bean low being in, then we could have the corn market find some good support, especially given those world stocks to use in corn are the tightest in 3 years. But clearly, like the others, I want to hedge into rallies. I'm not a potential long here in terms of other than just buying calls to replace lost bushels.
Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find the whole of our program to listen to online anytime you'd like at willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Mike Zuzulo at globalanalytics.biz. He's out of Atchison, Kansas. Jerry Gulke of the Gulke Group in Chicago, Illinois, and Elaine Cubb of Mastering the Grain Markets from Ipswich, South Dakota. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.